Session number 21564, Reel 29.
Colonel Cormac, Reel 29. I think you were saying you were invited to Chatham.
Yes, the operations in Northern Ireland had moved on a bit since my time there with 2-1 Engineer Regiment, and the emphasis on search operations had become much greater, and the requirement for positive search operations had become much greater. It was clear at the time that was the only positive operational move we could make. Most of the operations were defensive, but you could be become more aggressive, more positive by judicious search operations. So there was a need to produce a pamphlet on search operations which would cover the whole gamut of searching operations, from individual people, bicycles, motorbikes, cars, trucks, lorries, articulated lorries, buildings that were occupied, buildings that were unoccupied, rural areas or country areas or parks. All had a requirement to be searched at some time or other for some reason. But nothing had been done to put this into a structure. So I, using my limited past experience as infantry, I was invited to write the pamphlet on search operations. And I went to Chatham after Holland, to spend 6 months writing this pamphlet. And little did I know that I would stay for something like 16 years.
How did that come about?
Well, after I finished the pamphlet, that involved working with a search wing at the RSME that we were setting up to train people in search, trips to Ireland to see what was happening on the ground and get the up-to-date picture there. And I also took in a tour of the Ulster border with a view to giving some thought to how we might close the border effectively against IRA. That proved to be, frankly, quite impossible. But we had one or two ideas about blocking roads and tracks and so on. That was quite interesting.
Were you involved with the development of the Braithwaite tank?
Yes. And filling it with concrete. Yes. I remember the first one I saw, a very enthusiastic young troop commander from the Commando Engineers, because I was staying with them at the time. We went out, and he'd got this track, quite a substantial track, and thought we'd close it. So they built the Braithwaite tank over the track, and along came one of these mobile cement lorries and cement mixers. And the idea was to put the tank across the road, Braithwaite tank, and then block the entire road and fill it with concrete to make a really good obstacle. Well, the young man, in his enthusiasm, had neglected to make sure that the Braithwaite tank was on a nice, flat, solid, level base. It was on a slight angle. And as the cement was poured into the tank, the rivets at the bottom end of the slope bust, and the concrete went into the tank and shot straight through, much to his embarrassment and chagrin. But that was just a sidelight. That was one of the attempts to close it. Theoretically, it was a good idea, but the amount of preparation in a country area to make that level, to get the tank of sufficient length and strength to hold the concrete, it had to be absolutely level. Otherwise, the pressure on the bottom was too great. So it could work under some circumstances, but it wasn't terribly effective.
Another technique that seemed to be used often but had very limited lifespan was cratering.
Yes, very limited. Mm. It's mostly the vehicles that were crossing the border were agricultural ones. Mm. Tractors with, in fact, quite a reasonable cross-country performance. Mm. You crater a track, they would just virtually drive run. And there were so many tracks. Mm. And the boundary, as you're probably aware from the map, is so incredibly long because it curves and twists.
It is a serpentine boundary.
Absolutely. As if it was, get a fly drunk, dip him in ink, and let him crawl across the map, and that's the boundary. It was virtually impossible to close all the crossing points. it was almost impossible some places to see actually where the boundary was. And there were many cases where patrols had accidentally gone the other side, where the ever-alert Garda would capture them, but they never seemed to capture any IRA doing the same sort of thing. It was just a curious thought. But that was a sideline. But I spent a lot of time looking at areas and buildings and talking to the various brigades in their different areas, London area, Belfast, and the South Armagh areas in particular, as to what they were doing and what we could do to improve it, and so on. And out of that came the pamphlet, which was reasonably well received.
What was the basis of the pamphlet? Was there an existing pamphlet on search operations on which you could draw for basic principles and previous experience? There wasn't. No,
there was nothing. All I had to go on were a few operational notes existing in Northern Ireland, and one or two instructors' précis that they had made some notes themselves. And all that had to be put together in a formal sort of way, and all the various aspects of search. Mm. And I was greatly assisted in that by a fairly bright young man who had looked at the problem before I got there and had produced an appreciation. And he said, if I were an IRA, a terrorist organizer, if I were running a battalion or whatever it was, or a quartermaster of all the things they had in there, how would I go about concealing what I want to conceal in such a way that we can get it easily and the security forces couldn't find it? And that was an extremely useful publication, which we took and adapted and modified, but all credit to the young man. It was the first original piece of thinking on search that had been done at that time. And so we incorporated that into the pamphlet as a guide. Put yourself in the position of where would he put it? He would need to have his weapon in a place that it would be protected from natural elements, damp or whatever, that it could be found easily and quickly when required without actually giving its position away. So you have to have markers. You have to have indicators that you know which will point you in the right direction. Like there's a stake in the ground and you walk 10 paces to the north, then 3 paces to the west, and there, dig a hole, you'll find your gun. It had to be a bit better than that. And indeed it was. But that was very, very useful. And it did point to the troops on the ground searching, save them wasting time.
Sounds rather like the instructions for finding the treasure in Stevenson's book, Treasure Island.
Yes, that was very much in one's mind, yes. Mm. And then, of course, you hide the treasure when you find it and leave the place there.
Yes.
That's by the way. But it was very interesting. And then the techniques of searching cars and trucks. Mm. How to go about in a methodical sort of way.
Where did you get your information about that? Did you go to the REME or did you go to civil authorities like the police who'd had experience, or perhaps Customs and Excise might be a source of expertise on searching?
Well, I have to say that the police and the customs were not terribly good at that time. We, as a result of the pamphlet, which were some copies of which were sold to the Home Office, we had a police liaison officer attached to the search cell, which then became a search wing in its own right. It developed into a search wing at the RSMB in its own right. The Home Office then passed the pamphlet to the Customs and Excise. And as a little sideline, one of my chums on the Kent County Rugby Committee was a senior executive in Customs and Excise. And I was talking to him about rugby matters, and it broached on to how customs search things. And they were very interested in our book, because they had notes and they had some ideas about it, and they were used to taking cars apart and so on under certain circumstances. But they were very interested in the pamphlet and its later rewrites over the years as experience grew, and found it extremely helpful. So it served a much wider purpose than we thought originally.
Are there any common general principles to search, which apply to all forms of searching?
No, not really, apart from being methodical. But searching people is difficult, because you have to have one rule, set of rules for searching men. You have to have some other means of searching women. You have to have other means of searching children, because they were quite capable of carrying documents or weapons or ammunition about what could be more innocent. So you had to procedures, and you had to make sure you had a woman policeman or a WRAC military police or lady present. Obvious things, but they had to be stated and written down. Then you had to have, for a building that was either occupied or unoccupied, looking at the structure, you had to go about it in a certain way. If the building was occupied, you had to handle the occupants in a certain way, making sure, first of all, they were all gathered in one room, they were all then searched, and in front of everybody, and statements were taken that this was all done properly. Then the room was searched. Then they were all kept in that room, except one, who was then taken round as you searched everywhere to make sure that you didn't plant anything, because they were always ready to accuse you of planting evidence. And without going into much more detail, you had to write down and put down drills, procedures for all these things and how you can go about it. And it was quite very interesting work indeed. It in fact, led to a complete change of career for my part later on.
Oh.
After I'd done that book, which was modestly successful, it involved the first computer register of car numbers and little things like that that we established, which are now universally
very important part of the counterinsurgency as a whole.
Absolutely.
Keeping track of vehicles.
But all that, it was worthwhile, and I felt it was worthwhile. And I was then waiting for another job.
Yes. So you'd had 6 months at Chatham doing that.
Six months, round about, yes. Mm. Backwards and forwards to Ireland, or mostly there, and then back to the search wing and discussions with people. And then the pamphlet came out, and I was then waiting for another job.
What did you conclude about closing the border? Did you conclude that it just wasn't a practical proposition?
That was it. Mm. I mean, the main rail routes, you couldn't close, but you could block effectively and shut down when you wanted to. Mm. And there were a few other crossings that had a reasonable road that was worth... But it was so easy for people to slip across on foot or even on motorbike or bicycle or small vehicles, that it really wasn't a practical proposition to try and close the front of the border.
Presumably, though, it would be better to actually keep it under surveillance, in which case you could keep track of enemy movements and make some estimate of what they were likely to be doing next.
Absolutely, that was much more effective. Mm. As to what part the SAS would play in that is another matter. But clearly, observation of the border night and day. But the essential thing was then, and still is, to have the cooperation of the Garda on the other side and the Irish authorities then. Because without their cooperation, it was meaningless to watch the border and see who crossed it, because there were occasions when the IRA and their fellow terrorists could actually attack our forces from the Irish side. So unless you worked very closely with the Garda and the Irish Army, you were getting nowhere.
Did you have any liaison with those bodies, with the Garda and the Irish Army?
Not when I was doing it. Mm. I mean, there were and there are even more now. It's much more. Mm. I mean, cooperation is much better now than it ever was.
Yeah.
But in those early days, it wasn't too good. Mm. But that was obviously a prime requisite for any successful control of the border, if you like.
So what did you do then when this job writing the pamphlet about searching was complete?
They're doing a reorganisation of the headquarters staff at the RSME, and they had decided that in view of the increased scope of the work at headquarters and the RSME generally, that the old idea of a brigade major and a DA QMG and a GSU-2 and GSU-2 on the training side, that we should buff up the staff slightly and the created a post of GSO1, as it was then, and reorganized the staff. And the commandant asked if I would like to stay on and become the first GSO1 at the RSMB. And at the time, it wasn't a job that particularly appealed to me, but it meant I could stay in the same quarter. We wouldn't have another upset. I wouldn't have to move. So I accepted and stayed there. I was in that job for 18 months or 2 years.
What were the functions of that post of GSO1?
It was a proper coordination of the staff and also tightening up on. Again, we were just coming into the area of budgets, tighter budgets, financial control. If you were going to start a new course, you needed to work out how much it cost. You had to justify the money spent on every course.
Sounds more like civil service work than military work.
It was getting that way. You had to get hold of all the wings of the RSME. They had been called schools. But you couldn't have a royal school with different schools inside it, so they were all changed to wings, and get them to be more positive about their course planning. How many courses can they run? How many courses should they run? What is the need for a course? There's no use training X number of bricklayers B3 and Y numbers of bricklayers B2 and Z numbers of bricklayers B1. Just for the sake of doing it, you had to have a much clearer idea what the core requirement was for all the tradesmen that we were doing and had to have, and just tightening up that and getting people to think more positively in that way than just carrying on in a traditional manner. We were also responsible for improving YO training and making sure that was as effective as it should be. And then I was going back to supervising the clerk of works training and keeping an interest in that at a different level. It was just a change of emphasis, and it meant that I could talk to the school, the wing commandants, on a more level term than the brigade major. However effective and efficient he was, he was always one rank below them.
Yes,
and so it was all thought to be a more efficient way of running the stuff. And as these new ideas came in, so it became more important.
It sounds really also as though it's almost analogous to corporation management, dealing with resource allocation and defining requirements and things like that.
That's right. And also I had to put up these budgets to the engineer-in-chief. I had to work very closely with the ENC on the training side, because they were overall responsible for the engineer training. Engineer 6 it was then. Had general responsibility for the RSME and also for the training brigade at Aldershot, or Minley, as it was then at that time, and it still is. And I had to work with them and make sure that we were interpreting what the ENC actually wanted.
Well, what is ENC?
Engineer-in-Chief.
Oh, right. Sorry. Engineer-in-Chief, yes.
In those days, it was a major general. Now it's a brigadier. Yeah. That's the way things go.
Were his requirements static, or were they changing?
Well, they changed. They weren't always changing. We had to incorporate new ideas of training as they came in, and ways of looking at training, and as new equipments came in, that had to be looked at, and as the feedback from units that the NCOs you are training us are not quite up to standard in certain respects, or the YOs seem to be a bit behind on this aspect of their training. You were looking at that all the time to make sure we were meeting the requirements of the Corps and the Army overall. That in general terms, was what, and better staff coordination. And then after, I really flowed on from that job, and it seemed a natural progression. They set up a training development team for the Corps based at Chatham, which I was reporting directly to the engineer-in-chief. And this was another logical step forward.
Yes.
And it seemed a good idea if I would stay on and do that, because having been the first GSO1, then I moved to the training development team, which was then expanding. And that was another indication of even tighter control over training and training methods.
Was this essentially a sort of monitoring cell to keep an eye on?
It was more than that. Mm. We had to. There was a on the training side of the army generally. There was a thing called the Mellor Loop, had come into being, and someone had put this forward, and it was the, instead of training people as well as you could and make them really terrific, you then went to training them to what they had to do next.
Training for the next job.
They're training for the next job. Mm. And you started at the Mellor Loop, which is very simply certain progressions. You then looked at each employment, whether it was a young officer or a section commander or a tradesman, and said, first of all, we've got to write training objectives. What is he required to do? What is he really required to do? What are the essentials? And then you took that another stage forward and refined those to another stage and got those agreed by the Corps. Then that became the basis for the Corps syllabus. But each time you said, and then we looked at the thing again and said, do we really need Class 3 tradesmen? Can we do without Class 3 tradesmen? Because they're, after all, fairly basic. And so we modified the training, and people would then, on a basis of aptitude, start a modified class at Class 2 levels, mostly. Some trades had to be Class 3 for a while, but they were the exception. And so you looked at all those stages, and then you produce a course syllabus and targets, and then you went on to testing. And then you had standardized testing. We set up and manned question banks for all the subjects.
Sounds like an examination board.
And they all went on to the multi-choice question. Mm-hmm. And that was, I had two teams, one at Chatham and one at Minley, who were full-time running those, which we supervised. And my staff were most, I had an educating officer, I had a retired sapper officer and another major, I think that was it, plus a clerical staff and plus a lot of very senior warrant officers or experts in their particular field. And we then produced specimen exam papers for them, and then the training, the testing teams ran those, and then they were responsible for modifying them and bringing up to date, producing all the test papers, and making sure that the papers with the multi-choice question didn't repeat themselves. And they had it all moved slowly from the steam agent to computers, and then you could run off tests for electrician BA1 or a section commander doing his mines and demolitions part tests, and they all had to be validated. Did the question meet the needs, and were they four choices sensible ones? Did they confuse people, or were they neutral, and did they rely on good judgment? All sorts of things were going on at that time. And then you were looking at classroom techniques. And this is something with which you'll be familiar. We were just starting ideas. And you have a class of 25 people in front of you. And you say, now, what is the first immediate action on finding a mine? And they all put their hands up. And they know perfectly well, only one person
is going to answer.
So if whether they know or not, up goes the hand, and somebody answers it, and the instructor says, good, they've all got a grasp. Now we changed that onto consoles. And everyone had their desk, and they would have, multi-choice. The instructor would ask something, and they all had to press
the right key.
The right key. Mm. And he could see instantly whether 10% of the class got it right or 90% of the class got it right. Little things like that. Then we were looking at speeds of progress on courses. Should the class proceed at the pace of the slowest member? In which case, the bright ones would sit there twiddling the thumbs and get thoroughly bored. Or do you structure your course in such a way that if the chap does a 10-week course in 8 weeks, he can be deemed to pass and go on to do something else? that was the sort of work that we were involved with.
That involves setting and streaming, doesn't it?
Yes.
Effectively.
And then the chap who is clearly ahead of the game is recognised as such, and if it means promotion and pay quicker, then so be it.
And was this still... You said that you did this job, I think, was it for 6 months as GSO?
Well, no, it was more than that. I was there for just over a year and a bit.
Yes.
And this other job came up.
And then you were on this team.
Ran this team.
Training development team. Were you still a GSO1?
Yes, I was.
Yes. But you were working to the Engineer-in-Chief personally.
And I was lodging at the RSME.
Yes.
But as I knew everyone...
So you weren't part of RSME officially, but you were...
Yeah, I was just
you were physically there, not part of it, and you were working for the Engineer-in-Chief,
that's right.
Who presumably was in London.
He was. That meant I had to go up and see them pretty regularly again. But I was used to that because I was dealing with the same people, both in the ENC and at the RSME.
Where did your staff, the training development team, come from? Who were they?
From the Corps overall.
Yes.
The chap in the RAAC was an expert on training, and he had been... involved early on in the start of the Mether Loop system and these ideas. And from the school at Beaconsfield, they had ideas of which were almost the leaders in that field. So he was with me and very useful. So I had one chap of general experience, and then a retired sapper officer, an RO2, who had been an expert in technical training. And then I had the team of QMSIs, all warrant officers class 2, all of them highly recommended, highly qualified, many of whom would get to a WO1, and a clerical staff. And they were responsible for doing the initial training objectives.
How long did that job last then, as running the training development team?
Well, that team went on and on for years. There came a point...
But your part in it... Presumably, you didn't.
It was. I was after. I think I was there for about a year and a half. Again, 2 years, just enough time to get it going.
Yes.
An option came up. There was a very nice job at the RSME, running a publications team. And they required an editor. To run this team. And. One of the chaps, the RSME, came along to me and said, look, this is just up your street. Why don't you apply for it?
Is this because of your recent experience?
Because I've written
up
that pamphlet on search.
Yes.
And the current editor, Nick Carver, who was a very nice man, quite famous for being Montgomery's stepson, was very much in favour because he'd seen what I had done. And that was to say, that was a turning point. Having produced that pamphlet, I didn't realise what might lead to. It was fairly clear, I think, that my chances of further promotion were limited.
Why is that?
Well, I think you can tell as your age gets to a certain point, and nothing's happening. And this meant that I could be running my own boss as a retired officer and a retired officer class 1. And that had attractions again. I could stay where I was. What it meant was instead of living in a quarter, I could buy a house locally and settle down there. And so I applied for the job and got it, which meant that I had change of tack. I was now a civilian, but I had this...
Did you notice when you became a civilian?
No.
It was a painless transition.
Absolutely.
From military life to civilian life.
It couldn't have been more seamless. And it meant a fascinating job because I'd always known it existed. I knew more about it having produced this book because I had the setup was simply I was as editor, when I had four RO2 authors working for me, writing books. Writing the pamphlets according to their own special